WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, it's another Monday. Time for another Monday Night Talk. Don't mind that noise in the background as we're just printing off information for the show so our guests can be better informed. It is, of course, your President's Day edition. Oddly enough, you know, I got to say this. I've been fortunate over the past shows that usually somebody who has been on the program and is part of the opening somehow ends up on, has ended up on the show. Joe Rossi is that guy who actually outed me as not being from Marshall. But I will tell you that my family, Tachi's Unknown Anthem, have long had homes down on Tachi's and LaCroix's, if you knew your history, since, I want to say, the late 40s.
Where, in Marshfield?
In Marshfield, yes.
Well, that night you didn't fit the bill because it was you yourself.
Yeah, I'm like the mayor of Brockton, where, I have a family who's here, but I don't live here, so to speak.
Mayor Brockton went to Marshall High School.
He did. Yes. Yeah. He did, and I believe his dad still resides here. Yeah. Now, those voices you heard, so you're Joe Rossi, who is the on-again, off-again co-host.
Mostly off-again.
Off-again, only because... only those are mine. Those are my eyes, Jim. Guy tampering with my eyewear is state representative and good friend, Jim Cantwell, who... is here, Jim.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Welcome back. It was your turn in the rotation.
I appreciate it.
That's how we work here.
The three C's.
That's right. The famous law firm. Are you guys going to revive that commercial? That's my favorite commercial.
I think we shall. Yes.
Now, is it going to be the one that says, if there's not enough, cut out Jim's part?
No, I think this time we'll have to include...
Or cut out Josh's part.
This time we'll have to include Joan Moschino, so we can say that the three C's for the three guys, and then have her say, by the way, we have women running the show at the State House as well.
And, of course, just the inside joke is, during political season about a year and a half ago, Jim Cantwell, Josh Cutler, and Tom Coulter, just to show that the folks up at the State House do work together, and they work together well, did a very clever commercial. It was a spot. It was a political spot that I thought it's one of my favorites. Besides from the Marshall General Store.
There's a great, yeah,
Steve Carell. Those are fantastic. Yeah, with Steve Carell and Nancy and Tish. A great job that they do up there. But so Jim is here. Jim's going to, we're going to have a little bit of a conversation. I saw something that Jim had posted in regards to the president's infrastructure plans. I wanted to kind of have a conversation with him. Because I remember not too long back that under Barack Obama, president number 44, he actually had a stimulus plan. And I want to see if where Jim sits, because Jim, I made sure you got information. Okay, right. I printed it off for you. This is yours or mine. This might be yours.
Okay, thank you.
Take that. I don't want you to feel as though we have an unfair advantage that we got all this information and didn't furnish it with you, to you, so to speak. So Jim's here to talk a little bit about that. Joe, of course, I can't think of anybody who is better when it comes to flood insurance, knowing what the National Flood Insurance Plan, where it stands. Joe, I thought I'd have him come in for two reasons. A, he's a car lover like I am, more so than I am. So what does that mean? If Joe's here, usually somewhere lurking in the background, Junior D'Amato, our auto expert. And just as a special, special segment... You guys pay attention to what's going on with Bitcoin or cryptocurrency?
I'm aware of it, but what's the latest?
Oh,
they took a major loss.
Okay, but yeah, it's called a market correction. Mm-hmm. You'll learn all about that. I have a tech guru who's going to give us all the information. Mike Faherty is going to be with us at 7:30. So we got a fantastic conversation going on here this evening. Hopefully you're going to keep the radio dial set here. And I look in and do I have a thumbs up with Nancy Shack? Well, before we get to Nancy and find out what's happening out on the roadways, I want to let you know that it's being brought to you on this end by Brennan Smoke Shop, online at BrennanSmokeShopMA.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now Pope's Island, New Bedford. And joining us on the line is Nancy Shack to give you one last glimpse as to what's happening out on the roadways. What's happening, Nancy?
It's beautiful in one word. You'll never see nicer traffic. The expressway southbound is all clear top to bottom. Northbound, it looks good up past Andrews Square. 3 southbound, a lovely ride down past Route 139, 128. No delays from Newton down past Route 24. 24 and 95 south are both doing well down past 495. And at the Cape Cod Canal, both the bridges are free and clear. This report is brought to you by Unbound.org. You can be the difference between a child continuing their dream of education or leaving it behind. Help make the future brighter for one child at Unbound.org. Get traffic on the nines every single morning. I'm Nancy Shack in the WATD Traffic Center.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan Smoke Shop. I'm really striving to be the best smoke shop on the South Shore and South Coast in Massachusetts. If I'm not meeting that expectation, please let me know. And you can do so by private messaging me on Brennan Smoke Shop's Facebook page. The second you press send, it pops up on my smartphone and I will respond to you immediately. If we ran out of your product, you want to order product, message me on Facebook. If there's anything our employees could do better, please message me on Facebook. If there's an employee that's gone above and beyond your expectations, please message me on Facebook. Honestly, I feel really good about the people that I have working for my company. If we can be better, let me know. Message me on Brennan Smoke Shop's Facebook page. Brennan Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island, New Bedford. If you're not happy, you want to talk, or you want to complain to somebody, message me directly on Brennan Smoke Shop's Facebook page.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
So as I teased at the opening of the show, State Representative Jim Cantwell, representing the 4th Plymouth District.
That's correct.
Marshfield, Scituate.
Mm-hmm.
Is here. He's my guest. How are things going?
It could not be better. You know, things have been busy times, but all good things here on the South Shore.
Folks in the House of Representatives, are you getting your version of the budget ready? When do you guys release that?
What is that? That will be released. You'll see the formal release will happen early in April, on or about April 9th, and then the day after April vacation is when we'll do all our amendments. We'll have our budget will be done the end of April, then we pass it on to the Senate side. But you know, unlike past years, this year we're hoping for a little more movement. One thing people should know, even though right now we have the lowest unemployment rate really of our lifetime,
mm-hmm.
Consumer confidence is high, the stock market's been doing well. Even with all those things, we've had incredibly challenging budgets. And just as one example, the sales tax, right? Income tax is our largest form of revenue for the state, but the sales tax is very, very, very much, it's almost like 40% of the budget. And our sales tax has been off almost 20%. If you ask anyone who buys things online, if you're not buying it through Amazon, if you buy it from some other location, then ask them if they report at the end of the year when you're supposed to voluntarily report. I don't think anyone, you know. So Mass Retailers Association's been raising hell for years, saying that it's unfair that they are paying sales tax. It makes it hard for the bricks and mortars to compete, and the fact that a lot of these online folks are not. So it hurts online folks, it hurts the bricks and mortar folks, and it hurts the state government to do its functions. So it was a very challenging budget the last few years. This year, we're hoping for a little ability to do a little more, like funding TIC.
Well, thinking you're talking about revenue, talking about sales tax, well, right on the doorstep is a possible ballot question.
That's right.
We had Chip Faulkner on last week. We were kind of talking a little bit about that.
And the difficulty for that, I would say Deval Patrick a few years ago had an interesting take where they were saying since the income tax is still our mainstay and sales tax had been off, that he was talking of reducing the sales tax, increasing income tax overall, that would have been at least a greater way to depend upon what we were doing for revenue. Chip Faulkner and I, we don't always agree, and on this one I would not agree, but we do have to be fair to our bricks and mortar folks, and we have to find a way, you know, where they're paying their sales tax, they are feeling aggrieved, saying the 6.25% has made it difficult for them to compete with the online folks, so I understand where they're coming from. Question is always, what do we do if you have a dramatic loss of another, say, 20% of your sales tax income? We have to find ways to pay for a lot of these things, like infrastructure, which is why you invited me in tonight.
Absolutely. That was very nice. Mm. You were trying to do a segue there. Did you see that, Joe?
I like that.
Joe, do you want to ask him you want to get things started in regards to the infrastructure?
Yeah, let's just get things started and talk a little bit about this. I understand that you had and I saw your Facebook post the other day, Jim, talking about the coastal infrastructure being added as part of this bill, and you and I couldn't be more on the same track with that. Talk a little bit about your concerns with what this infrastructure bill potentially could or couldn't have. I personally have not even seen any part of this bill, but I do know, to your point, Jim, that it most likely will not include that major piece in it.
You're right, Joe. And the worry, it's something that's being echoed now all across the board in Massachusetts. The Boston Herald just did an editorial about this called Infrastructure Potluck, where they talked about the fact that the proposal, it sounds like a lot of money federally, for $200 billion over 10 years. But what the way it was being sold is saying this would be a great investment. You mentioned off air a moment ago, Kevin, about Obama when they had done ways of trying to accelerate investment. This proposal of the Trump administration calls for $1.5 trillion of investment, which sounds phenomenal. The difficulty, as the Boston Herald points out, and as Charlie Baker's Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack points out, and Jeff Beckwith from the Mass Municipal, the problem is they are flipping the way that those funds would come out. When in reality, where it used to be the federal government would pay 80% of transportation projects, and the state or the locals would do 20%, they're flipping that so that more of the money now would have to come from local governments that, frankly, I just stretched thin wouldn't have it. So my concern when I was writing on Facebook, and I'm honored that you guys were reading my Facebook post. I'm reaching beyond just my family.
It was in the news feed. It really was. It was in the news feed, but I saw it, and it was eye-catching.
Right.
And I was following some of the comments. But the first thing that popped up on my head was when Barack Obama put forth the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009.
Yes. Right.
The federal stimulus. There were a lot of conservative folks who were kind of jumping at it, going, "Oh, what are you doing? Hey, oh." So when I saw that you were kind of posting, you were questioning this, I wanted to kind of get your take as to, I want you to give me a comparison between the federal stimulus package that Barack Obama put forth back in 2009, and is it apples and oranges, or is there some stark differences? I think you actually began saying so, yes, where a part of this is, while you get the $200 billion that the federal government's going to put forth, the rest of it is going to fall on the backs of the state,
correct,
or local communities, right, or the county, or so have you.
Yeah, so the biggest difference, you'd say, because it's not exactly apples to apples, but the biggest difference under the Obama administration, ARRA, all those funds were going into existing programs, funding, like, for instance, in Massachusetts, we had the Accelerated Bridge Program, incredibly successful program that they replaced, I think, over 100 bridges just in a four-year span. It was very, very successful. But the federal government was paying 80% of that work. State was kicking in 20%. The stark difference right now is the federal government is going to reverse that. They will only do 20% of the funding. So you are going to see an increase. Right now, our state has, we are an older infrastructure state. We have tremendous needs. That will impact business. That will impact quality of life because you won't be able to see the kind of investments we've done in the past. So that's the first major difference. The other is, of that $1.5 trillion they say on paper, it's $200 billion from the federal government, but that's spread out over 10 years. The Obama, as folks recall, the idea of trying to get the economy back It was funding, and it was quick funding. And indeed, I had an example in Plymouth County. It was $8 million being allocated to Plymouth County to try to help quickly trying to do things that would be energy efficiencies. And we jumped right on it. We got a wind turbine in Scituate that was used in that money. We had a solar array in Scituate that used that. And in Marshall, we went to every single public building, and we used energy efficiencies. Did that really fast. Scituate now, by the way, 100% of its municipal energy is done from those two projects I mentioned that got assistance from the federal government from ARRA. So I was a big fan when I saw those types of things. And Joe, what you and I talk, because Joe and I worked years ago on seawall issues. Right now, the federal government's talking for FEMA. FEMA funds, this is different from the infrastructure, mm-hmm. but the FEMA funds, where in the past they could try to restore our seawalls to the condition they had been before the storm, a lot of that money is being zeroed out. That money they were being told was going to go to a wall down in Texas. And I would say to folks in Marshall and Scituate, we care a hell of a lot more about fixing our seawalls in Marshall and Scituate than we do of the wall. And it shouldn't be, you know, this... It isn't an us versus them. It's just saying that the priorities are not there, that where I think folks in my district would want to talk about having a different manner of a stimulus, a different form of federal package.
I know with the Barack Obama federal stimulus, a lot of it was judged upon shovel-ready. These had to be shovel-ready projects.
Yep.
Is there any language in that with the Trump administration's infrastructure package?
One of the good things that Trump infrastructure, what they're talking about is ways of trying to streamline permitting. Similar thing, because Obama was saying you needed shovel-ready. Here's an example. We used some federal funding here in Marshfield. We had a project that was on the books for 20 years to redo Route 139, to expand it from two lanes to four lanes, and to do a light right here at Enterprise Drive. 20 years we were waiting.
It's a beautiful light.
It is a beautiful
actually
light.
Actually, got you caught on the way in here.
It did. Yeah, I was texting. I'm like, I'm at the light, which is a good thing.
Right.
But that was an example with some federal funds, some state funds, a little bit of local. In order to do that project, it was a total of almost $5 million. But look at the difference that it's done by having a infrastructure investment by government. It's opened up. We've had six brand-new businesses come to the region. We're told we'll have 900 new permanent jobs here in Enterprise Drive as we have full build-out. That's an example of government infrastructure investment, and that's what's missing in this proposal from the Trump administration.
One of the things that I also was seeing here, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce mm-hmm. actually is pushing, in order to back this plan,
right,
a 25-cent increase in the federal gasoline tax to make that happen.
Right.
What do you guys feel about that?
The gas tax, if for people who are, I think, more conservative of wanting to see exactly where their funds go, the gas tax is one of those things that makes sense because you see it goes right to those dedicated projects. Mm. But I will tell you, having seen here in Massachusetts, we went up 3 pennies and people went ballistic. We hadn't raised it.
Well, that was a different animal because what that was, I believe it was a reoccurring gas tax that would have triggered. Compared to it being just 3 cents.
Yeah, it was an index. It was 3 pennies.
It was indexed.
Three pennies,
correct.
And then it would index like 0.01 of a penny for over to. Frankly, what the chamber here and other chambers in the past, if they see direct investment, if you know that when you're at the gas tank, you're putting something mm-hmm. in, and the percentage of that gas tax goes right to your roads and bridges. That's why conservative groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce support that, because they know it goes right back into these projects. It's something when, I use the example often here in Marshall when we built a new high school, if people know exactly where some of those new tax dollars are going and they see, when you see the actual project, you're more likely to be supportive. For the Chamber of Commerce, it is unique for them to come out and say they want to support a 25-cent increase is a large increase.
It's a big bump.
Yeah, and what normally happens, folks, if everyone listening, is usually you'll have one group that'll put a stake way out to one end. It's a bargaining issue. Here's the long-term thing that freaks me out is the gas tax is becoming less and less effective as our cars are becoming more energy efficient.
Topics. I mean, one of the topics with Junior is to talk about electric cars.
Right.
Those are the rage right now.
Yeah. They are. And we're going to have a lot more self-driving vehicles and the like. So the question will be, where does the money come to maintain your roads and bridges? And you know, there were proposals that we did not like that were made a few years ago of putting a little microchip right in your vehicle that would detect how many miles you were driving.
Oh,
like, yeah, yeah.
Open road tolling.
Yeah, yeah.
Brothers watching.
That was my worry. So that went down in flames a few years ago. But expect that kind of thing to perhaps come back when there aren't the funds to try to fix our roads, bridges, and seawalls and all the infrastructure we care about.
Joe.
Well, I was going to bring it. You know, like Jim has been talking about. I think you know one of the things that our from an infrastructure standpoint that we've been struggling with for years and years has been the funding of our coastal infrastructure. It's one piece that continuously gets looked over in both in the federal realm, and there's finally been some stuff, and Jim has been directly working at the state level with the revolving fund for low interest loans, which has been great. But at some point, I mean, in Jim, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about what you'd like to see at the federal level for assisting, you know, states. And it's not just Massachusetts. I mean, you go all the way down the coast, and while, you know, you take a look at a state like Florida that has to deal with more sand nourishment issues that we don't necessarily deal with, there's still, and there was a great article that I read today, that Florida's sand mining industry is coming under attack because of how quickly they're now losing these beaches and how quickly they now have to restore these beaches. And so it's not just a New England, Massachusetts problem, but I think, you know, Jim, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about what you'd either like to see or have seen, you know, at the federal level to deal with this.
Absolutely. For infrastructure, I was a co-founder of a group called the National Institute of Coastal and Harbor Infrastructure. And one of the things we keep repeating to folks, we have a triple threat that we're dealing with. Rising sea levels.
It's a big deal.
More frequent and intensive storms, mm-hmm. and our old crumbling infrastructure. And we need an investment priority that President Eisenhower did back when we had the interstate highway system. It was understood that it was a national priority that we would invest in these. It opened up areas for the economy. It made it easier for people to move around the country. If you travel around the world, you will see infrastructure in other areas of the world, airports that are in far better condition. Seaports, we have to do major dredging for Boston because we can't get some of the larger vessels now that can come in so we can have trade. Mm. We need that kind of impetus for federal infrastructure investment. And that's why I was writing so much that night about how disappointed I was that was the one thing that I thought the Trump administration was going to do where everybody was going to agree that these kinds of investments would make our lives better. And that's what I hope through, you know, it's a first round. It was a disappointing proposal. And again, it's not just me. This is the Boston Herald saying it. This is Stephanie Pollack in the governor's administration. This is Mass Municipal. Everyone was scratching their heads saying we thought that there was going to be something more meaningful coming out of the administration. And we hope that the Congress will be able to try to right the ship.
I guess I would ask you, was there anything that you gleaned out of the comments that you had on that Facebook post? Did anything that was... You know, with Facebook, there are some of those comments that you have to automatically take out because just sometimes people don't think when they post stuff on Facebook. But you can get a lot of good information.
Absolutely.
And good, thoughtful comments from right. people who at least care and are concerned with the situation. Did you get anything like that?
I did. What people were most concerned, the feedback was actually like the T. When people are saying, look at how poor Keolis right now, how they're not on time. They're not using the kind, they're supposed to have double-decker trains to take more people from the South Shore up. They've been doing the one single, looking at how poor the Red Line service has been. So people are losing faith in our public transportation, which is why more people are driving, and it's putting more of an emphasis on our roads and bridges. So that a lot of the comments I had back were saying, Jim, don't forget, you know, the federal government used to be there helping us on major improvements for our other forms of mass transportation, and that's where a lot of our investment should go, and hoping that would not be forgotten.
And it's interesting that you talk about, you bring up the T, because, you know, right on the doorstep right now, there's still a push for the South Coast Rail project.
Right.
For, you know, that's, you know, for trains, commuter rail trains to go down to New Bedford and Fall River. And a lot of folks thought that project would sunset with Governor Deval Patrick leaving office. But it seems as though Charlie Baker has picked up the ball and is continuing forward with that project.
And it was successive administrations, because I think there have been four different gubernatorial administrations that have all said this was important to do.
I thought back in 98 there was a test. I know there was a conversation back in the late 90s about trying to have a train, but there was a movement by folks down in the Taunton area.
Sure.
I covered this for a local newspaper. People were very, very passionate, and they thought they had turned away the state from wanting to put the train system down in there in that area. But when Deval Patrick was elected, that was one of his initiatives. One of his initiatives that he wanted to help folks get from the South Coast area to be able to come up into the Boston area.
And I think the thought, if for anyone who represents New Bedford or Fall River, that having access to Boston makes a tremendous difference for those struggling economies. The question is always going to be about technology. I will tell you, by the way, representing the South Shore, we're always saying we want to see the investments primarily fixing what we have now, and then saying if there's going to be expansions, that's fine, but we just have to make sure that there's the dedicated revenue that comes for that. So there's always a little bit of a tussle. You know, on the South Shore, my priority is let's fix what we have now, let's fix the Red Line, let's fix some of our Route 3, let's make sure we can have expanded capacity. What's interesting, in your next, one of your new speakers coming up, the changes in technology for if we'll have driverless cars.
Oh, yeah.
The estimates, Ford Motor Company was talking recently that they think car ownership is going to plummet with the next generation, so that you may not need to be expanding a lot of these roadways as much. You need to fix them. But they were casting doubt on, do we need to be expanding, adding lanes, sure, which is something I've been promoting for Route 3 for years.
And I've read a couple of articles in regards to the mass producing of, you know, driverless cars.
Right.
And that's something that all these big automotive companies are already investing in. They're already looking at mass producing, and, you know, the way of having a car that you drive, it could be
the thing
of the past, like the buggy whip.
Right. Well, they're most
the carriage, you know, the horse-driven carriage.
For the industry, what they use is they have clips of Joe Rossi driving, and they say, we can do this much safer. So I think that's, you know. So
bravo.
That,
yeah. Bravo.
I wouldn't disagree with that, actually.
Let's do this. Let's take a small break. And when we come back, Jim's gonna hang around for a bit, right?
Sure.
Jim's going to go from being the one who we are asking questions to be part of the conversation when we're talking with Joe, get an update from Joe as to where the National Flood Insurance, where it stands at this particular time, that program. You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options, like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
It's back in January, we had Joe on. Joe might have been on the second show of the year when we kind of got an idea as to where things were going. We were worried about the National Flood Insurance Program. We know that the can's been kicked down the road a bunch of times. And with the government shutdowns that we've seen, that it was good to have Joe back on. And again, like I said, we get Junior D'Amato coming up in the 7 o'clock hour.
Yep.
That's always good because there's a good conversation that goes on when we have Junior. And Joe is, like you said, a car enthusiast. And oddly enough, both he and I are in the car market. And we know that Junior likes to test drive cars from time to time.
Okay.
What do you got for a car, Jim?
I have a Ford Escape, a four-wheel drive, and then a Ford Fusion. I'm big, both made in America. Those little things that's, you know, stamp that tells you that they're can at least put together in America. I don't wear all the parts.
Good to know. I'll keep that in mind. I'll put that on the list.
The Ford Escape's great.
Okay.
Yep, my mom has one.
Yeah. Does she really?
Yep, highly recommend.
So we thought we'd have Joe in to talk about that. And also, Joe kind of made me aware when we were discussing him coming on. Again, Joe is the chair of the Marshfield Citizens Coastal Coalition. And I believe there's some work being done to... You guys trying to rebrand yourself? Or you're trying to do something to kind of put yourselves out there in a different manner?
Yeah, there's some different things going on. I appreciate you having me in here for a little bit. I guess first off, to tag along to Jim's segment about what's going on at the federal level, pretty much an update from where we were in January has been the exact same problem we had then, we have now. And we are extended to March 23rd in another short-term extension. Luckily, this time we didn't see any lapses other than, if you want to call a six-hour lapse in the federal government a lapse, then yes, we saw 6 hours. But no real lapse in the federal government spending. And what that means is the National Flood Insurance Program has been tied to the continuation of government being open. And so when the government expires and its continuing resolutions expire, then so does the National Flood Insurance Program. So we have been extended to March 23rd. Word on the street through various organizations and associations that I'm affiliated with would be that if we do not get a piece of longer reauthorization by March 23rd, consensus is we will get a year-long extension. What I have heard, and Jim, I'm sure you've heard similar, is the Senate refuses to take up the bill that the House passed back in November because they don't like the personalities on the House side. And so they...
So you're staving it off for midterms?
So they're staving it off. They're staving it off what they hope to be past midterm. So, and Jim, I don't know if you want to...
What I would say is, one, we're grateful for the fact this program has been so successful, and it would be disastrous for coastal communities if this program that underwrites risk to help folks, their insurance rates could be twice what they are without some of the underwriting. As far as the personalities, the program before was always in jeopardy. The chair... down in Texas,
Hensarling.
It had been one taking a much harder stand about flood insurance. The U.S. Senate has actually been far more our friends. We're lucky that Bill Keating here has been so good for this. Steve Lynch has been so good, the Massachusetts delegation. But over on the Republican-controlled House, it had been a real problem. So the hope had been, with the Senate bill, there was going to be investment. Here we go back. Investment in infrastructure, mitigation, which is lots of jobs. If we are able to invest in ways to try to prevent damage before it happens, there are studies that say for every $1 we spend in mitigation funds, either lifting homes up, fixing our seawalls, being able to try to redirect water, for every $1 we spend in mitigation, you save $4 to $6 in damage. So it was something that the Senate bill had been contemplating. We're very excited about. It does not exist for the Hensarling bill.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Jim, because the Hensarling piece of legislation called the 21st Century Flood Reform that had passed in November through the House, leaving the Senate up to move a bill, actually their overall goal was to remove the federal government's involvement overall in flood insurance and started to move the program that way successfully. In fact, one of the big reasons we haven't seen the Senate act is just that they are, it is my understanding that both Menendez and Schumer's office are opposed to any privatization of the National Flood Insurance Program. So that has been what has been staving off a more substantial bill in the Senate.
And the reason why people should be concerned, you know, it's good to always have competition. But the worry is you'd have these loss leading programs where people would say, join our program, we'll save a little bit from what the federal government has, you'd sign up with them, and then after a year, the rates would quadruple.
Skyrocket, and
you'd be. And if you left, if the act didn't allow people to go back into the federal program, there was always a question.
Yep.
If the act didn't allow you back in, people would get really hurt. Because it is uncontroverted, this program from when it was started in the late 60s, early 70s, right up until Hurricane Katrina, turned a $10 billion surplus when the federal government was running. It was being run very effectively. There's some concerns that we've had about its management. And certainly we've had multiple storms that we talked about before, the more frequent storms. So now that program is being utilized more often.
And again, that voice you're hearing, that's State Representative Jim Cantwell, kind of in on the conversation with me, speaking with Joe Rossi, who I deem a flood insurance. When it comes to flood insurance, this is his wheelhouse. This is what he does. He's also the chair of the Marshfield Citizens Coastal Coalition. And anytime there's any kind of movement or any new information, I try to make it a point to reach out to Joe. Joe will call me, go, hey, what do you think? Can I come on and can I chat about it? And then I go, okay, maybe I'll have Junior.
This time you reached out to me, actually, so thank
you. Well, again, seeing that we had two shutdowns,
yeah,
I thought it was worthy to have the conversation.
Yeah, no, it's timely.
And I think I want to kind of follow up and ask, what do you hear from folks who have policies who are nervous and every time they turn around that there's not a long-term solution that the federal government is putting forth to at least put people at ease, whether it's residential or commercial?
You know, it's funny you bring that up. So we've been sending out through the coalition updates on almost a bi-weekly basis at this point because of all these startups and shutdowns. Yeah. And we had some of our people on our newsletter and email list email us and say, stop, you're scaring away potential buyers from our house. And my response to that would be, well, there is reason to have concern, but there's also what we need to do is protect those that do have flood insurance, especially, you know, if you're selling a home, it actually should be more important now than it ever has been that you follow the changes in the National Flood Insurance Program. You know, I've been doing a lot of realtor education over the last couple months, and one of the things that I keep telling the realtors is the program changes once every 6 months. It changes every October 1st and April 1st. Rates increase every April 1st. And if you're not staying up to date every 6 months, this is outside of legislation. This is administrative changes that FEMA has the authority to implement. And if you're not staying up to date with those changes every 6 months, you're out of the loop on what's going on with the National Flood Insurance Program. I'll give you a quick example of that. On October 1st this past year, the refund, there was a change in the refunds. So if you had a policy and you, for one of the reasons, could cancel that policy, and there's only 26 reasons to cancel a flood policy, and you fell within one of those reasons, you could get a refund. But it would exclude certain fees and surcharges. Well, starting October 1st, now some of those fees and surcharges are refundable. Mm. So if you filed a refund on September 30th, and then that same person waited 2 days to file on October 2nd, the refund would change drastically. So those are the types of things that are important that people need to understand. The program changes fast.
Yeah. And Joe, and to reaffirm, one, it's so important for people to keep up in the education of the program, but also to be vigilant. And Kevin, to thank you, because WATD had been one of the leading voices when back in 2013, when Biggert Waters had passed. I was so proud coming, we'd say our two little towns, Marshfield and Scituate, people working together, being educated, working with our coastal coalitions. We changed federal law by people saying, no, we can't have a sales trigger. As you know, this doesn't exist anymore, but there was a requirement when someone sold their home, immediately they would go to the highest level for flood insurance. They actually
like a reset.
It was going to be, but it would be the A term for it. But requiring, you know, eliminating the sales trigger, part of the thing was helping people like the folks who own HAD ads, so that if people build their home in accordance with the zoning at that time and requirements, you could be grandfathered at the least. You'd be grandfathered to the rate that you have, not the same exact amount, but to the designation. Those were huge differences, and it was because we had meetings here with Senator Ed Markey came here and met Joe. You were there. We had a whole series of people who were realtors, who were bankers and the like. Sure. Elizabeth Warren came, Congressman Keating came. They all stayed, and Congressman Lynch stayed when the government shut down and fought like hell for us. So that's I was for people listening to WATD, your voice was heard. It meant a big difference, and that's why we want people to stay on top of this.
Covered extensively by the WATD News Department. Anytime there's a turn or a change, it's something that's reflective in our newscast. So.
And that really attention, you know, it's funny, Jim. You were speaking, today, and I got an email earlier today. I know you and I have talked about this before, but several of your state-based flood insurance bills caught the national radar again. So you'll be happy to know that you're making national headlines. And I got an email earlier today from one of those national associations calling my attention to some of those bills. So I thought it was funny.
Joe was in Arizona, and there were some bankers out there who were pissed off at me. I like that. You can believe that guy in Massachusetts.
That was funny. I couldn't believe it when I heard his name at a national conference.
So kind of give us, if you could, a brief snippet. So what happened was
Jim's got some Cantwell's, Jim always being an advocate. Well, yeah, and Jim being an advocate always of for consumer protection, filed and had passed at least one piece of consumer protective measures for flood insurance, where you only had to protect to or insure to your loan from Massachusetts only, and that caught the attention of a lot of and I'll say bankers, servicers, a lot of these other organizations, and it was brought up, and it was the very first national conference I had ever been to, and one of the major national consultants brought up Jim's name in front of a crowd of about 150 national experts in flood. Right. So I thought that was quite interesting.
And we got our bill passed into law in Massachusetts,
yes,
despite some of their concerns.
And so it's because of that national attention locally and through the work of the our coalition nationally as well, that we've gone through and are unveiling this year over the course of the next few months some major changes to what we're doing as a coalition. Right. I wanted to spend some time
please
talking
do that. Yep.
A little bit about
there are
that.
About 5 minutes left.
No, no, and that's all I'll need.
But please do, because it's important that folks have someone to turn if they have questions about this. And knowing that this is a radio station that is in a coastal community, I think it serves the purpose. It best serves the purpose to make sure that we try to put the information out on a regular basis.
Yeah, and so when our board sat down around this time last year to figure out where we were going, something was very obvious, and that was that we needed to actually start to offer some type of informational or hard services to our constituents, quite frankly, and that are the people that locally and nationally that read and go to our website. Over the last 2 or 3 years, we've had over 10,000 downloads on our website. Our website's been viewed thousands and thousands of times, all from people all over the country. And so we needed to start to reflect the way that we were viewed and how we looked and operated. The first thing that we decided and that we voted on and are starting to unveil this year is a name change. And we're moving to an acronym, actually. We are now the MCC. And we felt this appropriate because we didn't want to leave our local start right here in Marshfield, but we also wanted to be bigger at the same time. So the MCC means both Marshfield and Massachusetts Coast to Coalition, and that is the first major change. The second change is that we will very soon be an actual 501c3 organization. So that's a major change. You can donate to our group soon, and it will be tax deductible, and that was a great change that we're very close to completing. Our board of directors has expanded from 5 to 9. We have 2 seats left to fill.
Jim?
Potentially. We are looking for, we actually just filled our coastal scientist position. We can't reveal who it is yet, but they're nationally recognized in the field of coastal science. And so that person will be on our board of directors.
Somebody works out of Woods Hole?
I'm not saying anything. So that will happen, and our board is growing. We also actually got some national attention when we started doing this, and we're actually establishing in our bylaws, our new bylaws. That was another thing we did, was establish new bylaws. We have what's called our advisory board, and this is a board of at least 5 nationally recognized experts. We already have 2 committed to advise 3 times a year on the direction of the coalition. So they will be an advisory board that basically we check in with 3 times a year. They oversee what we're doing and help us guide us towards a better direction.
How important is that? How important is it that you have at least that guidance?
It's hugely important because that board, it will be officials from all over the country. We have one local official, one official out of the Midwest. We're working on assembling a few more that have been in the program and in flood insurance for dozens and dozens of years. So that will be an important board to have. And two of the other big changes that we're doing is, first, we have a new website, and actually that website is currently live. We've been slowly rolling it out. It's actually noflood.org. It's K-N-O-W as in no flood. Mm-hmm. And we have a few mottos we'll be revealing over the year with play on words with that. So noflood.org. And that is our new website. And the biggest change to our website, and this is really where we felt that the biggest change that we had to make was, is that we will be offering flood zone identification services to our consumers. So we finally have a contract with a national company that will be offering these services. So rather than going to the FEMA website to find out what flood zone you're in, you can simply go to ours. And so that will be a huge change. We'll actually have the official FEMA digital hazard map on our website, and that will be great for consumers. Realtors or the consumer themselves can actually purchase an official flood zone determination if they want to take it to the next step after they look at it on a map. So some of the services are free, some of them require to pay some money, but at the end of the day, we're just trying to offer more of those services. And I think the biggest question, Jim can attest to this, the biggest question we get asked is, well, what flood zone am I in? You know, where am I on the map? So we wanted to make that the center and focal point of what we did, at least digitally, right? We still have our downloads and our updates and all of that, but when you go to our website, the first thing you'll see is the National Flood Hazard layer over a map, so you can get an idea of where you truly are on a map. So those are some of the big changes, and we're really happy. We will be fully rolled out as the MCC by the end of next quarter.
Jim, last question.
I just, you know, Joe, it just sounds exciting because we saw how important it was just going back 3 years ago when you and I were on those weekly phone calls with folks from New Orleans, right? Caitlin Murray and the like.
Yep.
And the fact that you continue to go around the country and being able to learn best practices, advising on some legislation that we filed, it's a testament to your hard work, and it's exciting to hear some.
Well, the whole process has come a long way since the whole FEMA flood map incidents.
You know what's funny? That's true. And things have become more digitized, and it has changed. But Jim, it's funny. When I look back and I read through some of the FEMA documentation on the maps that were originally proposed, I think I said this to you before, that the stimulus package that was passed paid for those maps,
right,
and they actually stayed it right
that's
in
right.
the digital package. I thought that was tying it back to what we were talking about earlier.
Sure.
At the end of the day, though, we really wanted to provide better service, and I'm speaking at three national conferences this year, flood conferences, and at each one I continue to talk about how well we've done locally in advocating for our consumers, because no matter which conference it is, whether it's the Zone Determination Conference, the National Flood Conference, or the Servicer Conference up in Montana, the focus is lost on our consumer, right? And so that's why I'm asked a lot of the time to speak, is to bring it back to how does the policyholder view these changes. Funny enough, when I go out and speak in Arizona this spring in a couple weeks at that national conference there, I will be speaking about the newly mapped process. And one of the biggest points that I want to make in front of FEMA leadership is how confusing that process has been to our constituents. So,
and again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here at 959 WATD. Joe Rossi's going to take off his National Flood Insurance Program hat and put on his automotive cap. Representative Cantwell's going to hang in. When we come back, hour number two of this program. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And just like that, hour number two of Monday Night Talk. Don't forget that later on this hour, Michael Fahey, our talking tech guru. I think there might be somebody else. I think there might be another segment on this station. But Michael is he knows his stuff when it comes to Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, and some of the other things that are going on in regards to blockchain technology. You want to stay tuned for that. That's coming up. But don't go anywhere. Don't go to the refrigerator for a snack. Joining us right now is the car doctor himself, Junior D'Amato, guy that we love having on from time to time. I know he's a favorite guest of Joe's. As Joe and I said, I don't know, about half an hour ago, we are both in the market for vehicles, so we could talk to Junior about that. And I know that Jim already is all set with vehicles, but who knows? Maybe when your son is ready to go to Harvard,
there we go.
You can buy him a vehicle. So joining us with no further delay is Mr. Junior D'Amato. Sir, how are you?
Mr. Kevin Tachi, Joe, how are you guys doing?
We're good, and of course, like we got Representative Jim Cat. Well, you can call him Jim for short.
Mr. Jim, how are you, bud?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling in.
So, well, I really got a kick out of the flood insurance deal that we have because my house here is in a flood zone.
No way! Wow, that's interesting.
And the insurance went through the roof, and I said, "Geez, you know what? I've lived here so long. Make a long story short." Let me do some homework. Let me do some research. We got in touch with the people down at the DEP. I think that's whatever you might have called it at the time. And bottom line is we had it re-engineered, and like magic, we're out of the flood zone.
Good.
Yeah, got a Loma. That's great.
It was crazy.
Yep.
And so is what's going on in my world, guys. This is my world. It's automobiles. And, you know, it's probably the second largest investment that anybody makes. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Kevin Tachi, right now we are spinning around in circles.
Why is that?
Well, you look at it this way. I shouldn't, but Kevin, I know you're such a young guy. You don't probably remember the bag phones.
I actually do.
Do you?
Well, because I see them on TV.
Okay. Well,
some of those older TV shows.
I had a couple of bag phones, and those things were a couple of $1,000+ a piece. And when you had a bag phone, then you get to plug it into your car with an adapter, you were styling. You were the person. Mm-hmm. Anyway, now let's go ahead go about 35 years or 40 years ahead, and now we have phones that are keeping an eye on us. Yeah. Now we have cars that are going to be driving themselves.
Yep.
And, you know, years ago, did we ever think that we would have solar panels that actually worked?
It's true.
You know, and did we ever think that we'd be able to have a car starter from the manufacturer put in the car so we could start the car from inside the house factory? No.
Yeah.
Did we ever think back in the 70s, when 71 came along, we had catalytic converters starting around the corner, and 75 we had pollution smog devices, EGR valves, carburetors that were sealed from the factory, a Corvette with about 160 horsepower on a good day. Then it went to 180, and then all of a sudden, now we have 700-800 horsepower cars? No. We're getting good gas mileage, we're not polluting, and we have tires that are, you know, just going and going and going and not wearing out like they used to. I mean, things have really changed. Autonomous cars, I never even knew what that word was. Mm. But you know what? We are on the roll. We really, really are. Electric cars, yeah, we thought a little bit about that. By, I think, 2020, Volvo is going to not build any straight gasoline cars anymore. They're all going to be hybrids, which mean a plug-in hybrid, you know, with a gas motor.
Wow.
Things are changing quickly, my friend.
I was telling these two gentlemen that I did read something in regards to autonomous cars, that the big automakers are already, they're already planning, I want to say 10 years down the road, maybe not even that far, where they're going to be mass producing, you know, self-driving cars.
Well, you know, there are certain things I have privilege to. Many, many years ago, I was at the Ford Proving Grounds, and I said to one of the guys that was with us, I says, there's no one driving that car. He says, nope. You see all those poles? That's what's driving that car.
Hmm.
The car was just following, you know, was programmed to follow these poles. Audi had this many, many years ago as well, where in Germany, if you let go of the wheel and you were on particular roads, they had poles set up. So bingo, guess what? The car would basically not go off the road. It would stay in tune. It did not have the ability to accelerate and decelerate, but it did have the ability to go around at a particular speed for testing purposes, of course, and it worked.
Are they still working the bugs out of it, though?
They are. They're going to be working the bugs out of everything, Kevin. Are they still working the bugs out of radio programs like this here, where we're doing it remotely?
Yeah.
You know, are they doing? Are they still working the bugs out of everything? Yes. Everything has bugs in it. Everything gets worked out. That's why we have technical service bulletins and we have recalls on everything, whether it's a washing machine, a vacuum cleaner, or your favorite automobile.
Okay. Jim, did you have a question?
No, I'm just
Joe. Listening.
Well, I don't know if I should jump in so soon, but you know, Junior, I am in the market. Kevin and I are both in the market for a car. We are in the market. I have not been in the car market now for about 4 years.
Mm. And just to preface that, he is kind of a Chrysler kind of a guy.
Well, we knew that. He's a nut. And when I tell him what I drove Saturday, he's going to say, no way.
What'd you drive?
Well, you know, Saturday we were planning some snow, so I wanted to get ready just in case there was snow. And they threw me a set of keys to a Trackhawk Jeep.
Oh,
really?
After I got done playing with that, they said, well, you've already driven the best, now go to the second best. A 392, what is that called, the Durango?
Oh, the SRT Durango, yeah. Really?
Yeah, it was interesting.
And how was that?
It was very, very, very nice. Both cars were very laid back, easy to get in and out of, unlike the 4x4s of yesteryear. We had to actually jump into, especially a Grand Cherokee. If you weren't, you know, 5.5 feet tall, you'd have a problem getting in a Grand Cherokee because of the way the seat and the floor was. Mm. You really would have to either use the running board or you would have to, pull yourself up.
Well, you know, in the past, you know, I was saying this to one of my buddies the other day. I've gone through the phase where I had something fast and I had something fun. And now I think I'm in the time in my life, approaching the end of my 20s, where I would like something nice and luxury. So have you driven anything recently that has a lot of luxury to it?
Yeah, everything that's out there now is luxurious. If I tell you, one of my favorite cars, you're going to say, we got the wrong guy on the phone. I had a couple of Kias and Hyundais back to back.
Wow.
I'm hoping the Hyundai was a G90.
We've already been through that. I mean, those things were just absolutely incredible in race cars. The G80s are probably a lot better deal for your money.
Okay.
But either way, you're in great shape for cars. But getting into the SUV market, because that's really popular. The Hyundais and the Kia SUVs for, you know, $35,000 to $40,000 on average, they've got heated seats, steering wheels, ventilated seats, turbocharged engines, and they deliver optimum fuel mileage, and they get that 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. Plain English, I got to tell you, the newspaper columns, if anybody wants to Google it, we had them out a couple of weeks ago, and all you had to do is just read the last word, the last sentence. I wish that the manufacturers, other than Hyundai and Kia, would buy these cars, study these cars, so they can get back on track. Mm. I wrote a column maybe a month ago, basically, is how did this happen? That was it. How did this happen? And that was, how did the big three lose?
Mm.
And I wrote it, boy, did I get phone calls. Basically, they blew us out of the water. And now you have the import wars come in, and they have given us, you know, it's really sad when you come up to my house and the only thing probably American here in my driveway is a couple of old muscle cars, maybe a Corvette, and my snowblower. That's terrible. It really is. They have basically blew a lot of people away from buying American.
And again, we're speaking with Junior D'Amato. As he mentioned, Junior writes for Gatehouse Media, and you can see him in, I want to say Thursdays in the Ledger. You might see it in the sports section. There's the column.
Yeah, there's something going on with those two papers. I don't know what's happening with the Ledger and the Enterprise. I don't know what's going on. I think we were out of there for a couple of weeks. But you know what? It is what it is. Newspaper industry is really a tough, tough sell.
Struggling, yeah. But what I was going to say, Junior, is that one of the topics you and I kind of discussed, well, not discussed, but thought maybe it would be a good conversation, and maybe it's something that, Joe, you could kind of consider, is the all-wheel drive market and where it's at these days and how it's changed.
I'm looking at all-wheel drive when I'm looking for a car that is all-wheel drive. So
smart.
Yeah.
Smart move. And the reason why that's a smart move is because it's not like trying to shave your face with a dull razor anymore. You're not pulling it. No, I have to tell you, the difference between all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive is very simple. The difference is that an all-wheel drive car doesn't require any driver input. The problems were that you would scuff out a set of tires inside of 30,000 miles in the old days because there was not enough slippage with the center differential. What happens with an all-wheel drive car, all four tires want to go the same speed all the time. So now you take a left or take a right. Well, the inside tires, of course, aren't going to travel as far as the outside. What do you mean they're not going to travel? Well, that's exactly right. If the inside circumference, just get one of the little compasses and draw a circle. The bigger the circle, the longer in distance. When you take a left or a right, the tire that's taking on the inside is going to be going a lot slower. That means the tire on the outside is going to be trying to push the little guy on the inside around. That's called tire scuffing, and it adds tremendous amount of wear. Now we have cars with the center differential that has plenty of slippage built into it, so we're not wearing tires out anymore.
Hmm.
Case in point is I had a Challenger GT. What a great little car that is. It's a car for all seasons. And if you cut the wheel hard, go around a corner, you don't get into a fight with a steering wheel. Take the Dodge Charger, you don't get into a fight. Subaru, there's no fight. Take my Chevrolet pickup truck, that's an American vehicle, or any pickup truck that is four-wheel drive, put it in four-wheel drive, and cut the wheel left or right, go around a corner slowly, and that wheel is going to fight the bejesus out of you because it wants to bring the car steering back to straightness. That way there you're not scuffing the tires.
Mm.
Very simple, but all-wheel drive is definitely a big deal today. What about my last gas mileage? There is no last gas mileage. Maybe a quarter of a gallon, if that. But once you get rolling on the highway, it happens now with a lot of all-wheel drive vehicles, the percentage changes from 60-40, 50-50, 90-10 to the slippage rate that is built into that center differential. So you have nothing to worry about.
When you talk about all-wheel drive cars, they've worked out this problem. Would you say it's been the last couple of years, or going back to when, would you say?
The last 4 or 5 years. Okay. I mean, I had a customer of mine, very great customers. They had a lot of Volkswagen Passats, and every 22,000, 25,000 tops, we had to put tires on the vehicle. She complained to the dealer. The dealer says, there's nothing we can do about it. So she left them, and of course came to us, and that's when I told her, you know what, they didn't lie to you. It is what it is. You have a very short wheelbase vehicle. The wheelbase meaning the front and the back wheels are fairly close together, which accelerates the tire wear when you're going on a tight corner, with the exception of the new cars that have slippage built into them.
Go ahead, Jim.
No, I was looking, one of my things, I know you're going to talk electric cars soon. When you said before about Kia, Hyundai, others eating our lunch, what is the best American SUV?
I would say the Escape is probably one of the best ones out there.
Nice.
Jim just pulled a muscle, patting himself on the back.
Well, I mean, I get a new car to drive every week sometimes, too. I've got an $84,000 QX80 sitting in my driveway. I had three back-to-back Volvos within the past month.
Wow.
And you know what? I haven't seen a Generous Motors car in probably 6 months. Neither has anybody in my organization. And probably one of the best reasons for that is General Motors is afraid, I think, to give a journalist that's going to tell like it is a car. You can go buy an $80,000 Cadillac Escalade that's nothing but a big piece of plastic and a Chevrolet Tahoe underneath. And that is so terrible. You'll find everything, the brake lines, gas lines rotten in those cars. Unless they've changed them, I don't know. But I tell you, if I was going to go out and buy an SUV, a mid-size one, it would be either on the, if you can call American, it would be the Ford Escape. The Dodge Durango is a pretty decent car these days. Mm. I would stay away from General Motors if it was me.
I miss the days when you and I used to do radio during the times when it was Government Motors. Remember those days?
Yeah. Obama Motors, yeah, Government Motors. And they come out with, what's that thing they come out with, the clunker law or something?
Oh, yeah.
What a joke that was. Our friends down at Everett and Brockton and all the salvage yards, boy, are they smiling.
Oh, they are.
Go ahead, Joe. You actually touched on a car brand that I actually have been considering, which is Cadillac. And you know what was interesting was Cadillac was not at the Northeast American Auto Show in Boston this year. It was the first time I've been going to that show that they were not there. And I thought that a little odd. GM was there with Chevy and a few others, but Cadillac wasn't there. And I'm just wondering if you've driven the one that I had my eye on was maybe a couple-year-old CT6. I know that was featured as one of the premier American luxury sedans. I didn't know if you had driven anything in the Cadillac world recently and what your thoughts were.
They can't give that car away.
I can tell by the prices. That's why
I'm asking.
It's
so crazy. And you can get a CT6 or any of the other vehicles, and they all still have that plain, crappy plastic interior. You know, if you wanted to buy like a CTSV, a rear-wheel drive car, something like that, yeah. But other than that, I don't know what Cadillac has to offer anymore.
I know
they had that oil-burning, oil-leaking North Star V8. That, you know, every 500 miles, you had to put a quart of oil in it. And then when you brought it back, Cadillac would say, well, it's only $5,000 to do the gaskets in it.
Yep.
Well, the car's only got 65 or 70,000. Well, it's off warranty. We make them to break them. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, and I know, have you driven, last one I'll ask you specifically, because I know its biggest rival has been the Lincoln Continental, which I think is one of the most beautiful American cars right now.
It's a fabulous car to drive.
Yeah, and have you taken one of those for a test drive?
I had it for about 10 days. It was absolutely phenomenal.
Awesome.
Great gas mileage, 6-cylinder, twin turbos. It just does everything that it should. And again, if anybody wanted to read the review on it, just Google my name and you can go to, you know, wherever and find it. Google it probably and you can find it. And that probably is the best Lincoln that I've ever driven. Mine was silver. And now what they just did, they just come out with the God of all mother SUVs, the Navigator, again.
And my understanding is they can't make them fast enough now.
That and the big excursions, that's exactly correct.
Yeah.
And we had one of those we had a rodeo Saturday, and I mentioned it to Kevin, but we couldn't get together with getting a film crew out there. We had to probably have 75 cars. They were brought in car carriers and dropped off just for the day for the gentlemen of New England Motor Press Association.
Wow.
Junior, how far in advance do you know about this? Because if we could do it next year and I have some then I can get a camera crew together. That would be fantastic.
It happens every year. We probably know 90 days to 100 days in advance.
If we know that, then, and you know what? Maybe we do something on the radio station.
And we can feed you as well.
Compliments
of Dave Diner in Middleborough. Wow, what a spread they put out.
Can I tell you something? That's funny you mentioned Dave's Diner, because me and the missus went there. The missus and I. Thank you. I forgot you were a grammar teacher as well.
No, but I got scolded for that. I still have the marks on my income.
Okay, all right. Tell Carla I said hi, by the way.
Miss Carla, Kevin says hello. Go ahead.
We were amazed. It was about 6:30, 7:15, and the parking lot was filled, and people were just standing in line waiting to be seated. Nobody wanted to sit at the counter, and we're like, we walked in, and we're like, oh, anybody know how long? They're like, no, we're just standing here waiting for our turn. I'm like, okay, but it smelled delicious. People were just walking in. What's the beauty of that place?
Let me tell you.
This is in Middleborough.
If you ever like corned beef hash, you cannot buy it there.
Why?
Because you have to get two orders.
Oh.
It's so unbelievable. You eat one there and you take one home.
Okay.
They cut it out. They make it in a pan. You got to see the stuff they do there at Dave's Diner. Absolutely. When we go there, right, I don't even talk to the waitress. She sees us walk in. There goes the tea with milk on the side for me, tea with lemon for Carla. And I get my eggs and pancakes and my order of hash.
But see, you're like Representative Cantwell. You're a star.
No, they just know you when you go in there all the time. But it's unbelievable. It is what you would call soul food at great pricing, and the food is absolutely phenomenal. And you have a choice of either the real hash or the canned hash.
Yeah.
And that real hash, I take it home.
God bless you.
It's great to have. But anyway, back to the automobiles.
Let me ask you a question. I'm a little lazy right now, so I don't feel like Googling you and finding out your review on a car. But I, myself, was looking at, when you mentioned all-wheel drive, I've been looking at the Nissan Rogue all-wheel drive vehicles. Where do you stand with Nissan? That is a brand, and the Rogue.
The Rogue is a vehicle. It has what they call a CVT transmission, which is a continual variable transmission, and all you have to do is Google Nissan transmission problems. Over the years, boy, they had a tremendous amount of problems. But now they've all got it together. A continual variable transmission is basically having a go-kart with a clutch or a snowmobile with a cone that expands and contracts. That's what you have. But instead of having a rubber belt, you have a chain. And the chain now can actually click into gears as you go up and down the speedometer, or you use little paddle shifters. 5 years ago, the CVTs were absolutely crazy. In fact, if you remember what they called this Subaru Justy, that had a CVT that lasted probably about, maybe the first oil change, 3,000 miles, and it was junk. But now, no, the CVTs now, they are fine. Everybody's using them.
Now, I got to satisfy Jim's urge, because he wants to talk a little bit about the electric cars while we have a couple of moments left here. Where do we stand with electric cars, with the Bolt and the Volt and the Leaf?
Okay. The Leaf is something you can't even drive. It says it gives you 90 miles. I made it about 45 or 50.
Wow.
The Bolt is a car we have not get a chance to drive yet. The old Volt, V-O-L-T, was okay. One of my Hyundais, I made it to work, and I plugged it in as soon as I got there, and the gentleman that was picking it up, I says, you might want to wait an hour or so. We're still charging it. It says 33 miles, but you're lucky to get 25. He made it from High Park down to the gas station on Route 24 and had to be towed. There was a problem with it. Mm. I had a BMW E740 last week or 2 weeks ago, and that was, again, a hybrid with a four-cylinder with a turbo, probably one of the best little, hybrids I've driven in 100 years. It was great. But now we're finding the one problem with these vehicles is, well, two problems. One is the range is sometimes unacceptable, especially when you have the heater, the defroster on, or in the summertime with the air conditioner.
I heard that.
And, of course, the headlights. Next, will you go plug that in, honey, for me? Every night you got to plug it in. Once we get these cars to do an inductive charge, we are going to be absolutely phenomenal, and these cars then will start to sell, as well as when the price comes down. The problem, you have no idea how, you might think it's petty, how much of a pain it is to have to plug that car in every night, and if you're going to work, like I go to work 50, 60 miles, you got to plug that car in when you get there.
What are we talking for price right now? You said that the price has to come down. But what do you think, Junior, right now?
Well, right now you can buy the new, with the Musk's car. He just came out with that little electric car, and it's probably around $30,000. But the problem, again, is that you've got to plug it in every night, unless you're going just a few miles a day. And you might say, well, that's minimal. Okay, hey, honey, let's take a run down to the Cape. All right, so you get out of the Cape, all of a sudden now there's an accident in the Bourne Bridge or whatever, you're tied up. What are you going to do when you run out of power?
You have to plug a Mophie into it. Oh,
well,
no, it's only for my phone.
We can make all kinds of jokes about it, but you have to be very critical about not having an electric motor backup to charge that battery or an engine extender, as it's called. You're really going to be careful. But in 3 to 4 more years, we're going to find the prices are coming down, and the range is going to go up. Remember that, what was that, Stop and Shop? What was that store? The values go up, 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 and the prices go down, down, down?
Yep.
What was that store? Do you remember that? Was it Zayers?
It might have been Zayers or Caldor's or something like that.
No, it wasn't Cal. It was one of those crazy stores. But that was it. Robert Hall. That was it. Was Robert Hall.
Okay.
That's 100 years. That was way before you, Kevin. But anyway, if anybody that's interested in one of these vehicles, number one, go out and drive them. Number two, don't make a decision right then and there. And if you're just trying to price shop, get on the internet, let them call you, because you will not believe how the prices drop when you give them a little competition.
Last thing we'll ask you, we get about 4 minutes left in the in this segment, and that is last time we had you were on with Cape Auto Body's Dave Gallerani, and you two are like the titans on the South Shore here when it comes to automotive information and know-how. And we were discussing the state's inspection program. How has it been in the first couple of months for you?
Well, the first couple of months, you know, first 6 weeks, we had all kinds of troubles. There's no getting around there. There's no sugarcoating on it at all. The bottom line is the problems are pretty much worked out. We're probably at 6 or 7 months into it. The cameras are now up and running. The company has made every opportunity to make people happy. They try to go out of their way. Yeah, there was a lot of mistakes made at the beginning, Kevin. It's just like when you go for a driver's license and the registry man says, "Up, you didn't parallel park. Up, you didn't use the right-hand signal." After a while, you get it. You ride the bicycle, you fall off. But no, they've done a nice job with it now. I just wish that they'd be a little bit more in the communicative industry, communicating back and forth with us as being inspectors as far as going and getting classes, retrained. They are very, very strict. The cameras are out. Hey, can you let that go by? I got a bald tire. I got a broken tail light. Don't even ask the inspector to do that because the answer is going to be no. He's on candid camera.
Right. And if for some reason you get that individual gets stopped down the road, they have the footage of the shop not doing their job.
And all they need to do is look at that footage, and guess what, Kevin? Electronically, like hanging up a phone, they push the little button, and they shut you off completely, you know? Wow. So you got to do that. Now, for anybody that has darkened or black windows, and you cannot get a sticker because of that, if you've got a legitimate letter from a legitimate eye doctor saying that, the sun has detrimental effects on your eyes, that's what it takes to get the waiver for, you know, windows that are less than 35% in, clarity or darkness.
Junior, we want to thank you again for a fantastic segment. Anything you want to say in closing?
No, it's always fun talking with you guys. And, you know, just take your time when you're going to buy that car. If you don't want to buy that new car, buy a pre-owned car. And, yes, buy the extended warranty. And if you're buying a high-performance car and you can get with high-performance tires, and they're very, very narrow with a rim to tire clearance, you might want to think about getting the tire and rim protection plan. It's worth a few hundred dollars because one tire is going to cost you that, and a rim is going to cost you that. That's $600 for a tire and a wheel.
All right. Junior, we'll have to have you back on at the start of either towards the end of spring or the start of summer to get folks ready for the warmer months ahead.
Yeah, and just to let any of our listeners know, March 10th, over at Oak Point, it's a 50-plus community, I think a 55-plus community, is going to be a pretty big event that's going to be probably filmed by the local cable company. I'll be there. My buddy John Paul will be there. Lenny's Auto Body is going to be there. There will be a lot of automotive stuff. There's a very large automotive get-together club at the Oak Point housing down here in Middleborough.
Excellent. My friend, until next time, stay out of harm's way.
From all of me to all of you, you guys have a great time, and it's always a lot of fun.
Tell the cats I said hi.
Yeah, Will. Bye-bye.
Bye. There he is. Junior D'Amato, our guest for that segment. Guys, that was pretty good, huh?
That was really good.
Great. That would definitely help point me in the right direction.
Yeah, now I'm not going to have... You know, I was going to get a Rogue. Now I'm deviating away because of the variable, the transmission itself. The years I was looking at was the years of those problems with those transmissions. So, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for sitting in.
Thank you.
And when we come back on the other side, we're going to be speaking with Michael Faherty. He is our tech guru. We can talk a little bit about cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WBATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time,
You're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Dad, you know I'm willing to drive.
Honey, we're all set here.
But your eyes, you even say so yourself, don't like driving at night.
Well, that's why I'm following the plow.
But that's a sander, Dad. You know what they say.
It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
Oh!
Too late.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. It pays to stay way back. However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk.
Is our final segment of the evening. This is going to be a fun segment. As I indicated in our opening of the show, we like to do different things on the radio program, not just talk politics or news items, what's happening in the world, but you know, we like to kind of break new ground if possible. And interestingly enough, a gentleman who we had in here right around Christmas time, a gentleman who's been on a couple of times, we promote a particular show that he does, a fantastic show. And I bumped into him walking into the post office. And he's like, you know, do you do other subjects? I know I've been on for one particular subject, but would you be interested in talking digital currency, Bitcoin? I'm like, it intrigued me from him. I'm like, yeah, send me some stuff. So joining us as our final guest of the evening is Mr. Michael Faherty, and he is going to sit here and talk to us about not only Bitcoins, but talk to us about digital currency, talk to us about blockchain. He's kind of a guru in that. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Kevin, thank you so much for having me on to talk about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, digital currency. I'm hoping your listeners, their ears kind of perk up, because my experience is that most people have heard about it but have no idea what it is. They don't have any idea how it is or how it is going to affect our future, which 100% it is already affecting our future. So it's a good thing to talk about.
It definitely is. Myself, I only thought of Bitcoins as, again, one of those things that you could access via the internet, maybe be something that you'd be able to acquire through gameplay. There are a lot of gamers who use it, and Bitcoins are part of that currency where if you're successful at the game, you pile up those Bitcoins. But I became more aware of it. It's kind of odd because our discussion about it, about doing a segment, was a couple of weeks prior to, I believe, the Bitcoin trading at a rather high rate on the stock exchange. I believe it was. Do you remember what the number was? It was.
So it's not on the U.S. stock exchange,
no,
but there are exchanges, cryptocurrency exchanges, and it raised as high as 19,000 to 20,000.
Oh, okay.
Where it peaked out on some exchanges. So if you were one of those early adopters and you grabbed 2,000 Bitcoin, you were a multimillionaire at that point. Right now, today, as we talk, Bitcoin is running about 10,500. So there was a correction.
Okay, so it spiked, but then it as the market will tend to do, of course, you see major losses. It corrects itself. Well, you call yourself a futurist.
Yes.
Explain.
Well, I mean, I think I'm kind of hardwired in a way that I like to look out into the future, you know, maybe 10, 15, 25 years, and try to predict what's coming down the road. And if you do that, it really bumps you into a lot of technology that isn't yet or is just on the cusp of being. So, you know, as a futurist, you try to predict what the world will look like. But I think it makes you a little more embracing of new technology as well.
So what exactly? And I don't know if you want to thoroughly explain. What is Bitcoin? How was Bitcoin created?
I do. Well, let's talk about Bitcoin real first, quick. I do want to give you kind of the official definition of it, you know, so that we can start off from there. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency, a digital asset designed to work as a medium of exchange that uses cryptography to control its creation and management. So it is money. It is a means of exchange that is created through cryptography, which is kind of fun and funny, but everyone, cryptography is how you go ahead and secure certain documents and secure certain things. Cryptography is one of the base elements of Bitcoin and its creation, and it's built into the algorithm and how it's created.
Oh, okay. Now, you're somebody who has invested in Bitcoin. How well has that gone for you?
Investing in Bitcoin, so I'm going to give you kind of a funny thing. So what you do is you use an exchange like Coinbase. And Coinbase will allow you to invest U.S. money to buy Bitcoin, or you can buy Litecoin, or they have four other coins you can buy. So your entrance into the market usually goes through Bitcoin. And then once you're in the market, you can move your money from Coinbase to another exchange and begin to buy and sell other cryptocurrencies and other versions that are out there. There's over 1,000 right now. So if I went and I took my original investment in Bitcoin, you know, which was a couple thousand dollars, and I never invested in another cryptocurrency, didn't turn it into Litecoin or other things like that, I would have about $80,000 in profit, where I probably have a quarter of that now because I went ahead and I moved it into other things and experimented. But for me, it's part of the learning process. But if you bought and held, which some people can still do now, they can buy some Bitcoin and hold, there are predictions that Bitcoin will be $40,000, $50,000, $100,000. And I can kind of explain why if you're curious about that.
Please explain why.
So Bitcoin, let's say you wanted to put $100 and buy some Bitcoin. Bitcoin is digital. So once you buy some Bitcoin, you're not going to be able to afford the $10,500 and buy a Bitcoin. We have to stop thinking about it as a particular whole. What you do is you buy a piece of Bitcoin, and then that goes into your digital wallet. So you might have 0.002756 amount of Bitcoin or less. When you invest your $100, okay? So the entryway into cryptocurrency, the entryway for the entire world is usually Bitcoin. People only have heard about Bitcoin. They haven't heard about the other altcoins that are out there. So not just the U.S., but China and Russia and the entire world usually enters the market through Bitcoin, which drives up its price. So if you can picture a global market and everyone onboarding through Bitcoin, it really can scale to a point where the market value is in the billions and trillions of dollars that head into that coin. That's what pushes that price up. What are people willing to spend to buy a piece of Bitcoin?
What is the blockchain?
Blockchain is really important, and this is a buzzword that your listeners are going to hear moving forward for, I would say, for the next 10 years easily. Everything is going to be built on the blockchain. It's going to be the new buzzword. So let me give you the formal definition. The blockchain is a continuously growing list of records called blocks, which are linked and secured using cryptography. Each block typically contains a cryptographic hash of the previous block, a timestamp, and transaction data. So a blockchain is a public ledger, okay, that you or I could download ourselves. It is made available to everyone. And the way Bitcoin works is whenever Bitcoin is bought or sold or moved through cyberspace, there is a record of it built into the blockchain. Now, that blockchain uses cryptography and very hard math to go ahead and find a unique number. And once it finds that unique number, it stamps it. And then up to six other people, they're called Bitcoin miners, will do the same map. And once they all agree that that lines up, it will seal your record into the blockchain, and that which is linked to the one before it, which makes it very difficult to undo that. So the blockchain is decentralized. It is out in the wild. It uses incentives of these miners to go ahead and do the math that will seal your record forever. So blockchain technology is a decentralized ledger that is very, very secure in nature and not controlled by a single entity.
And there's nothing like you think there was a time where you'd have the gold standard, where you know, when you talk about currency, you talk about a country's currency, and they would have to have X amount of gold, you know, within their grasp to be able to print X amount of money. Where does it? What backs up a Bitcoin or blockchain?
Well, I would say a cryptocurrency is actually backed up by market share, its market cap. So there are real dollars behind them. So the total number of real dollars spent to buy Bitcoin creates a market cap. So right now, Bitcoin has the largest market coin cap out of all. So there is real money behind it. So if Bitcoin went from 10,000 to 20,000 tomorrow, you could cash out into real U.S. dollars based on the value.
What drove the price to where it peaked out at, you know, 20 and then corrected itself? What drives the price for Bitcoin?
So the like I said, the hype and the knowledge of cryptocurrency. So let's say I sent you a link that Fortune magazine now has the top
rich people
based on their Bitcoin value. That's so fantastic. So when people hear that, they're like, wow, you know, Bitcoin is not just a currency, but it's also a commodity that can be traded. So people get into the market, they're thinking, wow, I can make some money. And so people start to pour money in. As they do that, as the hype gets out there, as people learn that people are you know, 20-year-olds are becoming millionaires based on their thing, people begin to start investing. We have an old world of investment in stocks and bonds and commodities, and this is now the new world that people can now put their money into. So really, I think it's just it's an old habit called investing into a new medium, and it's driving up the price.
There was, you know, back when we were first talking about, you look at the dot-coms and prior to that, junk bonds. How is Bitcoins and blockchain different from that failed investment of junk bonds?
Yeah, that's a great idea. So let's just look at the internet. Okay, at the beginning of the internet, if you could grab a dot-com name, you were able to have investors pour millions of dollars into it. Pets.com was a great example of someone grabbing a domain, having a market idea of what it could do, and then investors invested millions of dollars thinking that people would want to buy their pet supplies online. Well, that Pet.com, after a few years, actually bellied up and went under because it didn't have a strong business plan. It wasn't thought out that way. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of altcoins, and there's going to be blockchain technology and ideas that get out there through initial coin offerings that are going to raise a lot of money, but it does not guarantee that it's going to be a viable project, that it's going to last the test of time. So, you know, there's over 1,000 altcoins out there right now. People believe that just a handful of them will survive the test of time and be the standard. You know, this is the Wild West of blockchain standards right now. So when it all, you know, is it going to be, bring me back to the DVD and the, you know, what were some of the video standards on VHS, beta?
VHS and beta. I mean, beta was, many thought that beta was the quality. But VHS was easier to mass produce, and it was cheaper, so folks went with that.
So the ultimate standard was adopted, and the other one went away. Same thing in the
crypto. The other one's in the museum somewhere. People, oh, remember that?
And there's also, you know, laser disc technology, yep, and other Blu-ray and things like that. Sure. So there's always who's going to adopt the standard, which one's going to win out, and we're kind of at the infancy stage of that, where things will thin out once there's an adoption of certain technologies. Again, it's all going to be built on blockchain technology, but which one wins out, and those ultimately will drive prices of those different ones.
Again, we're speaking with Michael Faherty, and Michael is kind of I'm personally going to call him an expert in this field, because he's somebody who is invested. He's a technology guy, a guy who kind of delves in, he keeps an eye on the future, and is willing to take a chance if it looks and feels and smells like it's the right thing. Okay, so let's say, all right, you've got the hook in my mouth. I like this, that this is a commodity, a future commodity that I want to be on the inside track of. even though I probably should have gotten involved with it probably 10 years ago, okay? Or something in the neighborhood of. So how do I go about buying? I can't buy a Bitcoin, but buy into a Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I think this is important, and I hope your listeners at this point actually grab a pen and take some notes, because I really think that everyone should dip their toe into this. I think the experience of this is going to help them understand how this all works. So let me bring you through the process. Number one, you're going to go to a safe and secure company, Coinbase, and they're based in the United States. And you're going to take, you need to be approved. They want to make sure you're a U.S. citizen. So you're going to create an account. They're going to ask for a driver's license. They're going to ask for your physical address. They're going to go ahead and approve you. That could take a number of days to be approved. But once you're approved and they realize that, you know, that you're not Al-Qaeda or some type of NSA threat, they're going to go ahead and give you an account. At that point, you can go ahead and link a bank account and go ahead and transfer some money over and buy your first Bitcoin. That's really the entryway for a lot of Americans into the market. They have to find a way where your U.S. dollars can buy Bitcoin. Okay, so Coinbase.com is a great company that does that. They do take a little bit of fees out of it. And Coinbase is also a very profitable company because it's the entryway for millions of Americans. And they had $1 billion posted profit last year just dealing with moving people's real money into the Bitcoin market. But, you know, there's a little bit of fees to get in there. Once you have Bitcoin, you can sit on it. You can hold it and just go for a wild ride, or you can then take that Bitcoin and move it to another exchange. Another exchange would be, for example, Bittrex.com, Kraken.com, or Poloniex.com. I believe Poloniex is Boston-based as far as their offices. And from there, you'll have access to hundreds of other coins that, you know, some are good, some are bad. You can buy into them. You can buy pieces of them, all with Bitcoin, and then watch your portfolio rise or drop based on the market. And it's just a fun thing to do. And I believe that everyone should enter the market just to wrap their brains around it and see how it works.
Any personal stories in regards to your early research into Bitcoin and maybe the government somehow intervening or getting involved? Do you any yeah. stories like that?
Yeah. So this one's a good one. So 2013, I purchased my first Bitcoin. I think I put about $2,000 into the market at that time and bought some Bitcoin. I immediately took my Bitcoin and bought with my Bitcoin something known as Litecoin. So Litecoin is the second most popular cryptocurrency that can be used as money, and it was up and coming technology. So I bought Litecoin at about $30 per coin. Okay, so I bought about 100. Some of it was bought at 17, some was bought all the way up to 30. So I bought about 100 Litecoin. Okay, and I bought it in an exchange called BTC-E. Okay, I went online, I found out that I can, from Coinbase, I could go ahead and buy Litecoin over there. I went ahead and moved it over there. Didn't do my research. Is this a US-based company? What is their background? It was just the way to do it, and I was just kind of aggressive. So a few years later, the US government comes in and shuts down BTCE. If you go to their website right now, it's a bobtomcat-e-energy, if you want the initials, btce.com. If you go there, you're going to see this nice graphic from the U.S. government that says it's been seized and taken over. And what they did is the owners of BTCE were involved in money laundering and bad money, and maybe they were involved in theft and other things. So there was, you know, this person was arrested. And right now, so that's been a few years now. So my Litecoin is still
tied up.
somewhere, don't know where, maybe it was laundered and maybe it's gone, but my Litecoin value, if we look at it at today's standard, because Litecoin's up to over $200, it's probably worth about $22,000.
Wow.
So I have calls into, you know, the Department of Justice, things like that on the West Coast. They're the ones handling it. And let's cross our fingers. Maybe I can get those Litecoin back.
Talk to me about the blockchain technology and how it's going to shape the future.
So since the blockchain is a very secure way to record a record, okay, and it's decentralized and it can run on its own once it's put out there, there are going to be a lot of other businesses that adopt this technology to do things, let's say, number one, cheaper. Okay, so if you run a business like I do and you process credit cards, they're going to charge you 2.5-2.9% to go ahead and run that money. So that's not money I keep. It goes to the credit card processor. And at the end of the year, it's a staggering amount of money that they go ahead and put into their pocket. Well, with blockchain technology, there are new companies that are coming out to go ahead and do the same transactions for you. And it's peer-to-peer, which means it's from the sender to the user, and it's at like 0.1% fees included to go ahead and move that money. Cryptography, the blockchain, and digital money makes it very easy for me to send you money without someone in the middle. So they can keep the cost down. So the whole blockchain technology will affect banking, will affect credit card processing. It's going to affect healthcare. It's already affecting energy, music, payroll services. Western Union is going to get, unless they figure out their plan, they charge a lot of money to move. There's a fee every time you move money from country to country. Mm. They are no longer needed because of the easy way to do this through third parties. So all of our traditional business models are all gonna have to adapt to a blockchain technology or go away. And we've seen this over time. Unfortunately, you know, I have friends who are in the cab company world. You know, we've built websites for them. We've done things like that. But Uber and Lyft and these other disruptors using technology bypassing the cab companies who have to pay thousands to get a token.
A medallion, yeah.
A medallion. Yep. Are now, so technology has this tendency to reinvent how things are done. So all of these industries based on blockchain technology are going to be able to do it faster, cheaper. They're not going to need middlemen. I think it's great that banks and all these people who have monopoly over our money are going to be challenged, but trust me, blockchain is going to be the new buzzword on everything.
My God, we have come a long way since back in the day when the early settlers were trading animal pelts and crops in order to, you know, to survive and get through. How about Joe Public? How will it change their lives?
Well, I'm going to back up based on what you just said.
Sure.
Trading, bartering, pelts, things like that. Yeah. So that is, so the government issues money, but if I wanted to barter with you, we can skip money and we can go ahead and have it on our own economic system,
sure.
which is not good for, you know, the government issued money because we're creating an economy outside of it. So one of the projects that I'm doing right now is we're creating our own crypto coin. Okay, and you can do that if you know C++ and you know code and things like that. Anyone can create their own coin. And then we can go ahead and mine our own coin and create it. So why would I want to create a coin? So I have a company called HireSite, and we're going to go ahead and create a HireSite coin. Okay, it'll be real. It'll be out in the wild. It'll be built on blockchain technology, and we're going to harvest these coins. So what am I going to do with these once I have them? Well, one of my ideas is, so we do a lot of business with people and for people. Right. So let's say I put a value of $10 on each of my HireSite coins, and then let's say you have a video company that can produce videos for me. What I can do is say, listen, I'll give you 100 HireSite coins that I can send to you. And in the future, when you need web technology and other things, you can cash in those coins with me. So I'm creating currency that bypasses traditional currency, which is a threat to any country, any government, things like that. But it's something that is coming our way. And regulation is also coming.
It's interesting. And again, we're speaking with Michael Faherty. He is kind of our expert when it comes to cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, blockchain. That's why I had him in. I thought it was a very interesting conversation to have, because it's that thing, because there's, you know, while we're sitting here talking about Bitcoin and where it's at, there's also something that's behind it. Like you said, there's over 1,000 cryptocurrencies that are out there today. But this is also tied into religion. There's a Bible prophecy that's kind of somehow woven in there too, isn't there?
Yeah. So real quick, and you know, there's a portion of your listeners that might find this interesting.
Absolutely.
But in the Bible, there's an end game. It's kind of how the world will end. The book of Revelation. Yep. And one of the players in the end game is the Antichrist. And what he does is he controls the world. There's a one world government, but he also controls the money. So I'm gonna read something real quick.
Please
here.
Do.
Revelation 13, it says, the Antichrist causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he has the mark of the beast. So we find this interesting that he will control the economy. He will control money. And the only way to do that is with digital money, with digital assets. So we're seeing here in this technology, we're finally seeing how these Bible prophecies could maybe actually come to pass. And it's just an interesting time to be alive.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in this evening and chatting about this technology, where it stands. Anything that we haven't discussed, but you want to take maybe 30 seconds to close out the show with?
I'll just say this, that cryptocurrency and digital assets and money, things like that, are not something that are going away. I would definitely say it is a technology. So never fear technology. Technology is neutral. It could be bad in evil people's hands, but good in good people's hands. So I would say embrace it. Try to dip your toe in the water. Buy some Bitcoin and, you know, have a taste of the future now.
There he is, Michael Faherty. He's been my guest for this portion of Monday Night Talk. If you missed any portion of it, it will be one of our podcasts that you will find. You can just go to our website at 959watd.com. And as you scroll down in the home page, you'll find the Monday Night Talk banner. Click on that and all of my podcasts. You'll find them, well, I wouldn't say the last few, but this, we're also in iTunes. So if folks want to check out some of our past podcasts, I think I have over 900 now that I don't know if they're in iTunes anymore, but I know that they're on the Podbean podcast account that I have. So check it out. That's all the program that we have here. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.